That's how it all began. That's how our country, a new experiment in freedom, began. To the sound of musket fire on the village green of a town called Lexington in a colony, one of 13, called Massachusetts. On that fateful morning, April 19th, in the year of 1775, dawn broke clear and bright. 70 minutemen stood in a line on the village green under the command of Captain John Parker, and this was the order.
Stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have a war, let it begin here.
That's how it began. The shots rang out. 8 minutemen fell dead. Our forefathers had gone to war. It would take some days before the electrifying news from New England would pass from mouth to mouth over 600 miles to Mount Vernon. Weeks before appropriate action could be taken to formalize this rebellion. 2 months, in fact, before George Washington would be called to his appointment with history. Until the musket shots of Lexington were heard, Washington was a man like other men. He hunted, he drank, he played poker, he laughed, and he knew hot anger, too, and the opposite sex. He was a man who could write such a note as this to a lady.
When once the woman has tempted us, and we have tasted the forbidden fruit, there is no such thing as checking our appetites, whatever the consequences may be.
Who knows what the consequences might have been if the one woman in his life, who was not his wife, had not gone off to England with her husband to live out her days. Her name was Sally Fairfax. And not only was she mistress of the plantation next to Mount Vernon, but she was also the sister-in-law of George Washington's half-brother, the much older half-brother who took him, after the death of their father, to Mount Vernon and taught him to ride and to survey the land, and taught him the ways of a Virginia gentleman, but who taught him naught about the evils of coveting his neighbor's wife. But Sally, or perhaps her husband, resolved all that by going off to England, and Washington settled down to being a good husband and true to a widow lady, wealthy by marriage, both in Virginia land and in slaves and in children. Her name, Martha Custis, and George Washington, a man much like other men of his time and of all time before in sense, ceased to be a bit of a carouser and settled down to caring for his ready-made family. He went to church, not so much that he was a religious man, but because it was the social thing to do. He became a vestryman at the age of 30 in Truro Parish. He became a warden of Pohick Church. He also did as other men did, enjoyed a hand of cards, wagered on the horses. On his tongue rolled good whiskey, enjoying every drop. In fact, he built himself a distillery at Mount Vernon. And just as all his plantation owner neighbors did, he speculated in land. And when all the land in Virginia was taken up, he, and the others too, looked west to the wilderness. The wilderness and Washington were not strangers to each other. As a young colonial officer, he had campaigned in the French and Indian Wars, learning well the art of what we today call guerrilla warfare. He had wanted to be a gentleman and an officer of the crown, but the long-hoped-for commission from London never came. And Washington, an angry man, returned to his half-brother's plantation to continue to learn the ways of a Virginia gentleman, and in time, to want to expand his holdings, as did all the others, westward. And that, if there was any one thing, that is what made a revolutionary of George Washington. It's not our purpose to trace here the roots of the rebellion that eventually bound these 13 colonies together in common purpose. Enough to say that Washington and the Virginia land speculators felt, like all the others, the oppressiveness of England's rule when it was decreed by London that they could not expand to the west. That privilege was reserved instead for Canadian colonials. In much the same way, every section of the new, raw land, every colony, had its reasons, its provocation. And then it was April 19th, 1775. and the muskets barked on Lexington Village Green, and the sound was heard around the world. And Washington, then age 43, as one of seven delegates from Virginia, went to the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia. Washington went wearing his uniform as a colonel in the Virginia militia. 6'3" and tall in the saddle, the only uniformed delegate to the Congress. And they chose him to be the commander-in-chief, no doubt impressed by the figure he cut, but mainly because he was a Southerner. And with New Englanders, Northerners, already in the field, it was good politics that the commander be from the South. And that night, Washington, a man sparse of words to describe a situation, wrote only this in his diary.
Dined at Burns. Spent the evening on a committee.
But legend has it that he also wrote this to his Martha, whom he called Patsy.
You may believe me, my dear Patsy, when I assure you in the most solemn manner that far from seeking this appointment, I have used every endeavor in my power to avoid it. Not only from unwillingness to part with you and the family, but from a consciousness of its being a trust too great for my capacity. But as it has been a kind of destiny that has thrown me upon this service, I shall hope that my undertaking is designed to answer some good purpose.
And so George Washington went to war, and a ragtag army went with him. They wrote songs about him and his men. Yankee Doodle was one. British buglers, when they sighted Washington, and the British came that close quite often, when they sighted him, they sounded the call meant for the sighting of a fox in a country hunt. And Washington, a poker player, played the game, fighting the war the way they played cards, close to the vest, bluffing when he thought he could, getting away with it, as good poker players sometimes do. The years and the places ticked by. Brandywine, Germantown, Trenton, Valley Forge. Valley Forge, so cold it was, so bitter cold. And every year, as long as the war lasted, at least once a year, Washington had to write a letter of complaint to a too complacent Congress. And in the winter of 1777, from Valley Forge, he had to write this.
To the President of Congress, few men have more than one shirt, and some none at all. We have, as a further proof of the inability of an army to perform the common duties of soldiers, we have a number of men confined to hospitals for want of shoes. We have, by a field count this day made, no less than 2,898 men now in camp, unfit for duty, because they are barefoot and otherwise naked.
That's the way it was at Valley Forge, and at other places too. But finally, the place was Yorktown, the surrender of Cornwallis, in October 1781. For most, the war was over, but two more years passed before Washington could go home to Mount Vernon, to rest, to be with family and friends. But finally, on December 4th, 1783, Washington, by then a man of 51, stood before his officers, glass in hand, in still-standing Frances Tavern in New York, and said, his voice trembling, his hand shaking,
I cannot come to each of you to take my leave, shall be obliged if you will each come and shake me by the hand.
And they came, and they shook him by the hand, every one of them. And then Washington at last went home, but not for long. 4 years later, his infant country called again, this time asking that he preside as president of the Constitutional Convention. The arguments were long and exhausting, historic, and Washington, not an intellectual man, but yet a wise man, indicated the kind of role he would later play when elected President of the United States. Not so much the executive as the magistrate, the arbiter of issues on which men like Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton and Franklin could not agree. And when the decisions were all at last made, Washington said this to Patrick Henry.
I wish the Constitution had been more perfect, but I sincerely believe it is the best that could be obtained at this time. And as a constitutional door is opened for amendment hereafter, the adoption of it under the present circumstances of the Union is, in my opinion, desirable.
The people then could elect a president, the first president. And Washington, in words of humility, wrote this to a friend.
My movements to the chair of government will be accompanied by feelings not unlike those of a culprit who is going to the place of his execution. So unwilling am I, in the evening of a life nearly consumed in public cares, to quit a peaceful abode for an ocean of difficulties without that competency of political skill, abilities, and inclination which is necessary to manage the helm. I am sensible that I am embarking the voice of my countrymen and a good name of my own on this voyage. But what returns will be made for them? Heaven alone can foretell.
And so on April 30th, 1789, he, George Washington, 57 years of age, was inaugurated as our nation's first president. George Washington's imprint upon the office of the presidency, one of creating precedent where no precedent existed before, has prevailed ever since. The selection of a cabinet, the delivery of the State of the Union message in person and annually to a joint session of Congress, the power to make foreign policy, the right to withhold information from the Congress and from the people, the appointments of justices of the Supreme Court, and the right to remove from office men that he had appointed to office, the inexpensive delivery of newspapers through the mail so that the people could be better informed, the right to send troops to quell disorder within a state. All these practices, all these precedents were established by Washington. There were other less important matters, but matters requiring definition nevertheless. How to address the president. There were some who wanted Washington to be king and to call him Your Majesty, Your Excellency, Your Highness. Some even wanted him to be called Saint. But while the people argued and while the Senate debated, the House acted. And ever since, it's been simply Mr. President. And so it went throughout two terms of office. He would not consent to a third. And then it was September of the year 1796, 6 months before his presidency would be over, 6 months before he could return to his beloved Mount Vernon. President George Washington issued his farewell address, addressed to all the people of the United States, and this is part of what he said.
The name of American, which belongs to you in your national capacity, must always exalt the just pride of patriotism.
Our first president, the father of our country, said that. And finally, in this, his last public utterance, these words.
In all the changes to which you may be invited, remember that time and habit are at least as necessary to fix the true character of governments as of other human institutions, that experience is the surest standard by which to test the real tendency of the existing Constitution.
And with these words, on March the 9th, 1797, President George Washington, 65 years old, his work finished, his duty done, went home at last to Mount Vernon.